Good morning, and welcome to Atheists Talk on KTNF AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. We appreciate you tuning in this morning. Today is Sunday, October 16th, and I'm your host, Stephanie Zavan. My guests today are Anthony Pinn and Mahad Muhammad. During this live show, we welcome your phone calls to 952-946-6205 and your emails to radio@minnesotaatheists.org. Yesterday at First Unitarian Society in Minneapolis, several groups, including First Unitarian, Humanists of Minnesota, and the American Humanist Association, came together to talk about the future of humanism. Panelists Anthony Pinn, Sunita Sarkar, Chris Stedman, William Hart, and Phil Zuckerman explored humanism's weaknesses and strengths and challenged us to challenge ourselves. Anthony Pinn is a professor of African American religion at Rice University in Houston, Texas. He's a prolific writer on black theology, including atheist theology, and he's worked hard to see both black religion and black non-belief appropriately recognized within the U.S. secular movement. He joins us today to talk about the conference and to continue to explore the topic. Good morning, Tony and Mahad. Welcome to Atheists Talk.
Good morning. Thank you for the invitation.
Good morning. Thanks for having me here as well.
So, if there's one thing that you would like people to know that came out of yesterday's conference, either a call to action or just something that maybe people aren't really thinking about, what would you like that to be?
I'd like people to recognize that humanism is thick, it's rich, it's complex, and at times contradictory. It's not simply what we think, but it's what we do.
Excellent. So, as I mentioned, we were talking about weaknesses and strengths. And obviously something that complicated does have certain weaknesses. Are there specific weaknesses that you see in humanism, not necessarily as fatal weaknesses, but, you know, as things, as opportunities for us as we're looking forward?
Well, that's a good word, opportunities. Let me just highlight a couple. One, I think it's too often the case that humanists will assume that science and attention to reason and logic is a safeguard against participation in nonsense. And so as a result, you end up with too many humanists believing that they really don't have any strong relationship to issues of social injustice because they are reasonable, rational people, and that all of our problems really stem from the supernatural, from religious claims. And this couldn't be further from the truth, that social injustice is a matter of human misconduct, and it doesn't matter whether one believes in gods or not. It's a matter of human misconduct, and it requires our participation. People fail to recognize that science and scientists exist within cultural worlds, and they are often influenced and informed by these cultural worlds. I don't know another way to explain the Tuskegee experiment, for example. And so I think that needs to be addressed. I also think it's the case that too often humanist and humanist communities don't provide people with a safe place to land. That is to say that they assume critique of religion is sufficient, not recognizing that people also crave the opportunity to ritualize life, to celebrate moments of wonder and awe, and this doesn't require attention to the supernatural, and that they crave, on some level, community and connection, and simply critiquing religion doesn't offer ritual, doesn't offer community, doesn't offer folks a safe place and a comfortable place to land.
That's a very interesting point, because I think it brings up lack of maybe research or knowledge that is prevalent in a lot of folks in our movements that don't necessarily, I think, have done the work in terms of when it comes to what scientism has also meant, mm-hmm. Specifically to, say, people of color. And I know one of the experiments you mentioned was the Tuskegee airmen and what happened to them. I mean, you can go down the line on with what happened to Henrietta Locke. Mm-hmm. You can go down the line with, back in the 18th century with the noted physician Samuel A. Cartwright coming up with a term, right, drapetomania. So there's a long list of scientism that went beyond your typical science theories of actually impacting lives, but that it became a way to marginalize and subjugate, where people would say, you know, this is not just something that we're saying. There is an actual scientific reasoning and facts behind it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So can one of you, and I, maybe we'll have Tony do this, you bring up scientism, and I know that's a word that tends to get people to just kind of stop thinking about what you're talking about. Can you tell us a little bit, in other words, what it is that we're saying when we say scientism in this context?
I'd like to think about it this way, that scientism revolves around replacing notions of God, for example, with that same sort of deep regard, uncritical response to science.
So scientism, when we're thinking about it, is actually something that is in conflict with how science works when it works, because science is self-critical, or should be.
Should be.
Right. Excellent. Also, following up in terms of a safe place to land. So, I mean, it's there was a certain irony in saying that in something that was a church. What is it that's missing when we get humanist groups together? Because a lot of them are doing that. You're talking about ritual. What is it that we're looking to take? Because we don't want to necessarily take the bad parts of ritual. What is it that we're trying to take away and add back into our humanist communities when we're leaving some of the harms of religion behind?
Well, ritual in and of itself is neutral, right? So there are some in the study of religion, for example, who argue that ritual is simply repeated activity in founded space. So there are ways in which the American Humanist Association's annual meeting is a matter of ritual. It is repeated activity in founded space. And I think that's important. And I would agree with you. There are some humanist organizations and some individuals who are thinking along those lines. But it seems to me there are still organizations and individuals who cannot think about ritual or a quest for meaning outside of the realm of theology and theism. And I think it's that kind of conflict, it's that kind of uncertainty that poses a problem. And I think in a more general sense, humanists have a difficult time with mourning and celebrating the occurrences of life, that often our conversation regarding death is clinical and rather cold.
And actually, one of the things that you said yesterday, I think, fits in really well here. You were talking about religion as a tool, as opposed to religion being equated with theism. Is this the same sort of thing that you're trying to separate the what it is that we're doing when we are practicing a religion as opposed to believing?
I think there are certain questions that are strictly human questions, period, right? We are self-aware creatures, and we desire responses to the fundamental questions of our existence. Who are we? What are we? Why are we? Where are we? When are we? And religion is one mechanism, one strategy for addressing those issues. But disbelief in a variety of forms is yet another way of addressing and responding to those issues. So I'm simply saying that theism is really what most humanists and atheists have in mind. And we use this general category of religion, but religion is simply a binding together. Again, from my perspective, religion is simply a technique, a strategy for trying to make sense of a world that seems rather absurd.
So if we were talking about something that you would call a religion or a religious practice that is not theist, I'm guessing a lot of our audience is having trouble conceptualizing that at the moment. Can you give us an example?
I would argue, and this doesn't make me very popular, that humanism qualifies as a religious orientation. Right? I'll take seriously what you say concerning ritual being present within certain humanist organizations. there are belief structures within those organizations. There are patterns of conduct. There are patterns of thought. There's a desire to find within the context of life meaning. And so based upon my definition of religion, humanism would qualify.
All right. Sorry, I'm trying to think. We're coming up against a commercial relatively soon, and I don't want to hugely change the subject.
On that subject, actually, I think one of the things that kind of happens too often in our movement, I think, is lack of also understanding kind of the emotions and the feelings behind what people are feeling, where we feel like we can kind of solve issues by reasoning our way in with critical thinking and not taking human emotions and feelings into consideration.
That's absolutely right. Absolutely right.
Yeah. And sometimes we go even further than that. We specifically devalue emotion. You're saying we're losing something when we're doing that.
We are losing something when we do that.
All right. So when we do come back from the break, I want to change the subject a little bit. I want to get into some of those questions of what people are talking about when they say, you know, humanism has problems and needs to fix certain things. And there was an interesting take on that at the conference that I think Sunita brought up, but I'd love to discuss. But for now, please stay with us through the break, and we will return to Atheists Talk with our guests Tony Pinn and Mahat Muhammad. I'm Stephanie Zavan, and you're listening to AM 950 KTNF, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Welcome back to AM 950 KTNF, the progressive voice of Minnesota. This is Atheists Talk, and I'm your host, Stephanie Zavan. This is a live show, and we welcome questions at 952-946-6205 or emailed to radio at minnesotaatheists.org. Atheists Talk is an unusual show. Very few places in the U.S. can someone randomly turn on commercial radio and hear a bunch of atheists talking about topics that interest them. Increasing your visibility this way does have costs, however, and we need your help. If you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation to our radio fund, please visit minnesotaatheists.org. Today's guests are Anthony Pinn and Mahat Muhammad. Welcome back, Tony and Mahat.
Thank you.
So before we went to break, I promised I was going to bring up a comment from Sunita Sarkar, one of the panelists yesterday, when I asked the question, whose voices are not included in humanism? She challenged me on looking at specific groups of people as though they represented specific viewpoints and that kind of thing. She called it bean counting. I was appropriately chastened. But at the same time, it is true that if we're talking about viewpoints, humanism has not always done a great job of speaking to people who have particular kinds of viewpoints. Can you address that a little bit?
A couple of things. First, it's too often the case that humanists will want to believe that for so-called racial minorities, for example, that humanism is a new thing, not recognizing that African Americans, for instance, have embraced this sort of orientation for as long as they've been in North America. This is not a new thing for us. It's not a borrowed tradition. And folks will assume that humanism and folks who come to it do so because of this strong appeal to reason and it requires formal education. No. The challenges of life experience will bring people to humanism when they can no longer find a working response to this theological question, what can you say about God in light of moral evil in the world? When they can't find a satisfying answer that maintains God on that throne, they move to traditions like humanism. I'd also say that too often within the context of humanist organizations, there's an assumption that difference is a problem to solve, that it's a type of virus that we need to wipe out, rather than recognizing that difference is our strength. Difference is a good thing. that we can appreciate our commonalities while also respecting and recognizing our strong differences. In terms of missing voices within these movements, I think intent really, really matters. Why do we want this sort of diversity within our organizations and within our movements? What is the intent in having that? Is it simply to say, look, we have these folks over here. Aren't we really good people? Or is it really to alter how we do what we do and what we think and to expand our reach into communities that need what we offer? But I think lastly that humanist organizations and individuals who ask that question of diversity aren't really prepared for an answer because it involves surrendering something. Unless folks really want just more shades of the same within their organizations, bringing in this diversity of thought, this the diversity of experience, requires some fundamental changes to structure, to agendas, and to thinking.
Well, and I've talked to Alex Jules actually fairly recently about this, and he said, you know, I'm done talking about diversity because I have talked to all of these groups and I've told them what they need to do, and I go back and nobody's doing it. And so that question of being willing to make fundamental changes, I think, speaks to that.
And what I will not accept in having these conversations, I'm not quite tired of them yet. The tone often annoys me, but I'm not tired of the conversations yet. What I will not accept, though, is ignorance as an excuse. Right? I don't know anything about this community. I don't know anything about that community. Unacceptable. This is 2016. At the very least, you can do a Google search and find out something about the culture of that particular group. So the idea that ignorance somehow covers and removes responsibility is just unacceptable.
Not to mention not very humanist. Ignorance is not one of our values.
Yeah. And what that, I think, ignorance that you mentioned covers is the contributions that have been made to humanism and to atheism by people of color through literature and in many other ways. I mean, A. Philip Randolph and the contributions he made. And going back even, I think historian Will Durant was the one that mentioned that atheism and humanism was prevalent in Africa, where there were pygmy tribes that really had no superstitions. They buried their dead and really just didn't know anything about, you know, God. So I think that ignorance of thinking that humanism or atheism is in the context of something that came out of only the Enlightenment, I think it does a disservice to a lot of folks, whether it's Zora Neale Hurston or other folks who continue to do great work today, like Sikivu Hutchinson and Leo Igwe in Nigeria. And I think it's something that we really need to be better at.
And it's just plain lazy.
It is.
Yeah. Well, and it continues a tradition of erasing voices that have always been there.
Sure.
And because when we do ask the question, you know, where are the black humanists? I'm looking at a couple of them, and they're not, you're not, hard to find.
We're legion.
You are. So if you wanted to talk to an organization about taking some concrete steps, the things that they need to be willing to change, what would you be saying at this point?
First, remove the ignorance. Do some reading. Right? There's plenty of literature that gives you a sense of how humanism functions within the context of diverse communities. Do some reading. Secondly, move outside of the comfort zone. Become comfortable with risk, with vulnerability. That, from my perspective, we really can't make progress if we're engaged in conversations that allow us to remain comfortable. We have to be exposed, and that involves moving beyond comfort, acknowledging where we've fallen short, venturing out, finding out what communities need provided, and don't assume you get the leadership position. Take your marching orders and stay in your lane.
So you talk about being comfortable or being uncomfortable. You do a lot of talking to groups about things like this. Is that comfortable for you? Are those comfortable conversations for you when you're standing up in a room and dealing with, among other things, ignorance?
Well, no, because these conversations also expose me to the extent I'm interested in social justice. Take sexism, for example. I am a part of this, right? There are ways in which I exercise both explicit and implicit privilege. And having a conversation concerning humanism's need to more radically address sexism exposes me because I am part of the problem.
All right. Thank you very much. And we will keep exploring some of these topics when we come back from commercial. So please stay with us through the break, and we will return to Atheists Talk with our guests Anthony Pinn and Mahad Muhammad. This is Stephanie Zavan, and you're listening to AM 950, KTNF, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Welcome back to Atheists Talk on AM 950 KTNF, the progressive voice of Minnesota. I'm your host, Stephanie Zavan. Atheists Talk is produced with funding from the Minnesota Atheists, the Humanists of Minnesota, American Atheists, Farmers Insurance Agent Georgia Hancock Tsui, and Cucumbers Restaurant. If you'd like to advertise on the program, please contact us at radio@minnesotaatheists.org. The music for our show is composed by member Brent Michael Davids. If you have a question or comment on today's show, please call us at 952-946-6205 or email to radio@minnesotaatheists.org. Anthony Pinn and Mahad Muhammad are with us today, talking this morning about humanism's strengths and weaknesses.
Sikivu Hutchinson, writer of White Knights, Black Paradise, Godless Americana, Race and Religious Rebels, with Black Skeptics of Los Angeles in 2013 spearheaded their first in the family of humanist scholarship initiatives, which focuses on providing resources to undocumented foster care, homeless, and LGBTQ youth who will be first in their families to go to college, responding directly to the school-to-prison pipeline. That is a phenomenal scholarship. What can the humanists and the atheist communities to do to support a program like that?
Dr. Hutchinson is a brilliant scholar and an inspired activist. First thing we need to do is recognize the contribution she's making to these movements, right? That her work is fundamental. Her organizations, her work can be supported financially, right? That what the good work she's doing requires resource, and those who have it can provide it. It also seems to me that good conversation, good buzz concerning what she's doing is vital. Let folks know about this good work and be in touch. I would assume is a good thing to do as well. Be in touch with her and see what you can do within your areas to address similar issues.
I'm also going to put in a little plug for the now called the Secular Social Justice Conference, which she's been part of organizing, because those have been really impressive conversations that I think have made everybody who participates in them stretch and get a little uncomfortable talking about some topics that really need to be explored and are well within the humanist wheelhouse.
Yes, yes.
So bringing us back to then discomfort, there were other things that we were talking about yesterday where we need to be less comfortable, or where we've gotten maybe a little too comfortable, might even call it complacent. You and other speakers challenged us several times to think about the things that we were rejecting about religion. We've already talked about ritual. One of those things that came up more than once was mystery. You want to address both, I think, how we as humanists reject it and what we should be finding in there and appreciating in there.
I think too often humanists assume that mystery or wonder or awe involve a surrender to the supernatural, a loss of reason and a loss of logic, as opposed to what it can really entail for us is just a deep appreciation for the complexities of life within the context of historical experience, that this is a wonder. and that we ought to recognize how tremendous, how fantastic, in the best sense of the word, our existence is, and appreciate that.
Yeah, I think we do it a little every once in a while, not so much in terms of looking at people, but it seems almost that we need like pictures from the Hubble telescope these days to make us feel awe and wonder. But people, you think people are okay?
I think people are messy. We are complex. We are messy creatures. And one of the real benefits of humanism at its best is a recognition that we have capacity for great good and for great harm, and that we are accountable and responsible for what takes place, that we have certain obligations that need to be fulfilled that only we can fulfill.
Excellent. So are there other things where we're maybe a little too uncomfortable with parts of religion that we ought to take another look at?
Well, here's one issue. I think when it comes to humanist and humanism, we want the larger population to understand our complexities, to understand the nuance behind this position. But when it comes to religion, we throw everyone in the same fundamentalist evangelical bag and don't recognize the diversity, don't recognize the complexity.
And that's really brings up a good point that and I'm sure this is a question that you get asked a lot, and I'm sure every person of color that goes to a lot of these conferences and chapter meetings gets asked in terms of why, you know, the number of 87% of black folks living in America are Christians, even though Christianity has enslaved Africans, and not realizing, like you've said, the complexities of also having other religions that exist within the people of color communities, whether it's Islam, I think, being – or black Muslims being the, perhaps the second biggest outside of Christianity in America. You know, voodoo, you talk about down in Louisiana. So what would you say to someone asking that question?
Yeah, after I stop laughing.
Yeah.
Well, as you said, the religious landscape of African American communities is complex, it's nuanced, and often contradictory. But what folks have to recognize is Christianity, for example, pacified, but it also fueled deep revolt. Nat Turner, Denmark Vesey, Gabriel Prosser were all Christian ministers who understood that their Christian allegiance required the freeing of black folks, right?
Yeah.
There are ways in which even this Christian tradition has worked to secure the well-being of blacks. That cannot be forgotten. It's also the case that humanists make a huge mistake. And this is the question. What has humanism offered these communities? You tell them to leave churches when the historical record for humanism is not stellar. I'll give you an example. I don't know very many humanists who don't claim Thomas Jefferson. Although he was more likely a deist, humanists claim him. And what they don't recognize is this. In claiming Thomas Jefferson, they not only claim democratic vision, separation of church and state, they claim slavery and sexual abuse.
Very true.
So the question becomes, yeah, there have been problems with Christianity and other forms of theism, but historically, what has humanism offered these same so-called communities of color?
Well, and we're talking about, you know, kind of buried threads of humanism within black culture. We have things that we could be offering them in our humanist history, in our humanist past, and humanist scholars, but we're not. I mean, we're not actually making that part of our intellectual tradition. We're not making that part of, unless we're, you know, it's February and we want to put up a billboard in the black community. We're not treating folks like Zora Neale Hurston as part of our intellectual tradition that we put forward that people need to know about.
Of course not. If you look at the major text relating to the history of free thought or humanism or atheism, you are hard-pressed to find substantive conversation concerning so-called racial minorities, right? This is just missing. Again, there's a bizarre assumption that white Americans have had this tradition for a very long time, but it's new to everyone else. Just completely, completely inaccurate.
And as we were just talking about with Sakivu, how are we doing on contemporary, recognizing contemporary work by black humanists?
We're not doing such a great job, right? And we can think about this in a variety of ways. I'll give you one example. Let's think about book sales related to humanism that explores African-Americans, for example, over against book sales regarding the assumed whiteness of humanism. We're not talking about the same sort of numbers. And not because these texts aren't available to the humanist community, but it's considered a footnote, an extra.
Well, and I'm not going to pretend I don't know that having two black men in my studio on an atheist radio show is an unusual thing. I'm aware of that. So we need to get better at putting people front and center who are doing this kind of work.
It has to matter to humanists, right? So-called racial minorities have to matter to this larger humanist community.
And not just to put butts in the seats.
Or show us off.
All right. We have just a couple minutes left. What other kinds of things should we be doing within humanism, either to be recognizing the black humanists who are already here, or even just more generally to be addressing issues and viewpoints that we don't?
I think as a kind of general operating principle within humanist communities and humanist organizations, there needs to be accountability and responsibility for issues of social justice beyond the usual suspects. So rather than simply having African Americans, for example, speaking about racial injustice at the AHA and other organizations, have some whites speaking about racial justice as if this is only an issue for so-called racial minorities, that this larger population has to take accountability and responsibility for these issues as well, and invite so-called racial minorities to talk about their expertise beyond their identity politics.
You do things that aren't related specifically to being black?
So surprise, surprise.
Oh. All right. Anything else that we should be doing to broaden viewpoints or broaden the viewpoints that we address?
Study and learn. It's really that simple. Study and learn. Humanists have to expose themselves to difference. Study and learn.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Tony, for both the conference yesterday and that footage. A good chunk of it should be online, and the plans are there to spread that widely, so hopefully it'll get heard quite a bit. Thank you, Mahad, for, again, being there yesterday, being part of planning it,
thank you. And
being here this morning. I'd also like to thank our audience for tuning in to Atheists Talk. I'm Stephanie Zavan, your host. Join us again next Sunday. For now, stay tuned for American Atheist Viewpoint. I am proud to be on the air with Minnesota Atheists, and I hope that you appreciate the show. This show depends on the generous support of our members, our sponsors, and our donors. Please consider supporting the show through the donation link at minnesotaatheists.org. This is Atheists Talk on AM 950, KTNF, the progressive voice of Minnesota. The podcast for this show will be on our radio page later today, along with the podcasts for all of our shows. Have a nice Sunday, everybody.
Hello, and welcome to the American Atheist Viewpoint for Sunday, October 16th, 2016. I'm Nick Fish, National Program Director for American Atheists, and thank you, as always, for joining us. This week, we want to talk a little bit about some election news, obviously. Certainly no shortage of things coming out in the presidential race. A lot of evangelical support for Donald Trump has stuck around, and I think that that's really prompting some interesting conversations when you compare the support that appears to be in on some level. I don't want to say supporting, but it certainly looks like there might be some cracks in the evangelical firewall of Donald Trump's support. And the differences between the rank and file of the evangelical movement with the leadership. So, you know, you have people like Ralph Reed and Jerry Falwell Jr. and other sort of movers and shakers, Tony Perkins, the leader of the Family Research Council, all continuing to support Donald Trump in spite of all of the allegations that have come out recently about Donald Trump's past of sexual impropriety or potentially sexual assault against women. But they're sticking by their candidate. They're saying that we're not electing him to be moral. We're electing him for policy, I suppose. And this is interesting when you compare it to the new figures that are out that were reported on by the National Review, talking about the number of the growing number of people who are no longer going to support Trump. So something like 55% of evangelicals are voting for Trump or prefer Trump over Clinton, but huge numbers are no longer going to be voting for Trump. So that's 3 out of 10 undecided and a huge number that just say they're not going to vote for anybody. This is a big deal. This really speaks to the weakening of power that we're seeing from the religious right in this year's election, that they don't have anybody who's really speaking their language. Donald Trump is kind of going through the motions, but it's clear that he's uncomfortable wearing this mantle, and he doesn't really know what he's talking about when it comes to certain religious markers and the speaking their language of the language of evangelical Christianity. So a lot of people now are saying vote your conscience. A lot of evangelical leaders are telling their supporters vote your conscience, whatever that means. So this is something we have to keep an eye on, and just it's something that really warrants further review. And it'll be interesting to see the exit poll numbers once the election's over, to see how exactly the evangelicals voted in this election and what percentage of support came in Donald Trump's coalition came from evangelicals. The next thing that I think needs to be addressed here is some news or a video that came out from Kentucky, where Kentucky Governor Matt Bevin, a Republican, was videotaped telling a group of preachers to essentially ignore the IRS's regulations that ban churches from endorsing candidates from the pulpit. Now, this shouldn't come as any surprise. This shouldn't be shocking in any way, unfortunately, because this happens constantly. The Religious Freedom Days or the Free Speech Days, whatever they call it, where the group of evangelicals get together and say, okay, this is the day that we're all going to get up on our pulpits and we're going to politic from the pulpit, and we're actually going to send video of that to the IRS and essentially challenge the IRS to do something about it. And they don't. The IRS does not follow through on this. The IRS does not go in and investigate this or take any adverse action against groups that are abusing their 501c3 tax-exempt status to engage in politicking. Bevin, for his part, said to this group, it was a group of churches. It was a pastor appreciation forum. And he said, do you know how many churches have lost their tax-exempt status because of political speech or preaching that has occurred? Zero. He told the audience there's nothing to fear from the Johnson Amendment, which Donald Trump has proposed repealing, because it's essentially toothless. And as we all know, one of the worst things about this is that the IRS specifically has guidance that says that they can't initiate audits or looking into the actions of a church in particular unless it's initiated by a senior member of the team. That really speaks to the privilege that's given to religious organizations to operate with impunity and get the tax-exempt benefits, got all the sort of additional things that 501c3 organizations like American Atheists or like any other secular organization, the benefits that we have to file forms and fill out all kinds of disclosures and accept certain limitations on the free speech of the organization. That is part of the price that you pay in order to have that tax-exempt status. Having a tax-exempt status is not a right. Speech is. So, you know, it's a trade-off. If you want to engage in that sort of speech, don't request tax-exempt status. It's pretty simple. The government is the rulemaker on that, and if you don't like the rules, if you don't want to abide by those rules while you have that benefit, then don't claim the benefit. And that's really one of the more frustrating, you know, sides of this, that they view this as an affront on free speech or an attack on free speech, but in reality what it is they don't want to play by the same rules as everyone else. And, you know, this has been the consistent marker of the religious right for quite some time, that they think they're entitled to special treatment simply because of their religion. So they don't want to have to follow anti-discrimination laws. They don't want to have to follow, you know, IRS rules. They don't want to have to follow these things simply because it inconveniences them, or they think they're entitled to some sort of benefit from the government, but then they don't want to play by the rules that you have to follow in order to claim those benefits. You're perfectly free as a person to, you know, not want to have to talk with people or deal with people who you think are sinful. But as soon as you go into business in the public sector and provide some sort of public accommodation, you have to follow the rules. And you're free to preach however you want. But as soon as you start accepting donations and wanting the tax exempt status that comes with that, then yes, there are going to be limitations on your speech. So that's a trade-off, and it's something you have to decide if it's the right way for you to go, or if it's the thing that you want. And if it's not, don't do it. I don't know how this could be clearer. Last thing that I just want to briefly touch on here, sort of a news of the weird. Oklahoma Governor Mary Fallon is amending a declaration for an oil field prayer day, because her initial declaration only included Christians. It said something about Christians recognize that Christians are invited to thank God for his blessings created by the oil and natural gas industry. They amended it saying maybe our language wasn't inclusive enough. The fact that we're actually having an oil field prayer day is pretty stunning. So the inclusiveness of the measure is probably one of the least bad problems with it. So anyway, that's all we have time for this week. Thank you, as always, for joining us for the American Atheist Viewpoint. For more information about our work or to become a member, go ahead and visit www.atheists.org. As I mentioned last week, we have a donor match going on right now, where if you become a monthly sustaining member, making modest monthly contributions, spreading your giving out through the year, your contribution will be matched dollar for dollar for the first year. You can learn more about that at atheists.org/monthly. In addition, if you sign up with that, you get a free subscription to our magazine, as well as all the normal member benefits. Thank you, as always, and we'll talk to you next week.